the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Many of today's workers will lack the resources to retire at traditional ages and maintain their standard of living in retirement. Solving the problem is a major challenge in today's environment, in which the risk and responsibility have shifted from government employers to individuals. Joining me on the program is Professor Monell. She is the Peter F. Drucker Professor of Management Sciences at Boston's College. And she is co-author of a book called Falling Short, The Coming Retirement Crisis and What to Do About It. Professor, at one time it was called the Golden Age, where individuals went to work for companies, they retired, they got a percentage of their salary in a fixed pension, and combined with Social Security, they lived rather well. When did that end, and what caused it to come to that end?
So I'm glad we're talking about this, because we worry a lot about whether people are going to have enough money when they stop working, and our conclusion is they're not. So there was a period where most people were covered by old-fashioned defined benefit plans. And I shouldn't say most people, because it's always been about half the population. But those who had coverage were automatically in the plan, and they tend to stay with their employer. And then when they got to retirement, they were guaranteed an income for life. That combined with Social Security, where you got a full benefit at 65, provided an adequate base of income for people to live, and they really didn't have to worry about a lot. And so we have had a whole bunch of things happen that have made the outlook less rosy. On the program side, where Social Security is in the process of increasing the retirement age from 65 to 67. So what that means, if somebody continues to retire at 65, that they get an actuarially reduced benefit. And then we also have rapidly rising Medicare costs, and Medicare premiums are deducted by the benefit before the person sees it. And for middle-income people, these benefits are going to be subject to tax under the personal income tax. So there are just a lot of factors that mean sort of the net amount that people are going to get from Social Security is much less relative to pre-retirement earnings than it used to be. On top of Social Security, we have employer-sponsored plans, as I said. But those employer-sponsored plans have changed from those old-fashioned defined benefit plans, where you got an income for life, to 401k plans, where people have to build up their own pile of assets, and then they have to figure out how to use them when they stop working. So on the supply side, sort of the supply side of income, we're seeing less going to the individual, whereas on the demand side, people need more because they're living longer, they have to support themselves over a longer period of time. We're in a very low interest rate environment where whatever money you have doesn't get you very much unless you take risks. And so we have this mismatch between a decline in retirement income and an increase in retirement needs.
You know, at one time, in fact, if you take the concept of retirement itself, it's rather a new phenomenon of the 20th century, because prior to that, Professor, I wonder if you might address, most people worked until they could no longer work. I wonder if you might cover that.
So in up to the turn of the last century, most people lived on the farm or in environments where they could either continue working as long as they lived, or if they couldn't work, then they were in an environment where family could take care of them. So actually, the need to have income for retirement is a 20th century phenomenon.
So as you talk about this crisis today, which is a changing environment where Social Security is covering less, we no longer have the security of these defined benefit pension plans, how did we get ourselves in such a fix? Because we had Social Security. I mean, is it a number of these things? Is it employers backing away from pension plans, government maybe shouldering and putting maybe a little bit more of that responsibility onto the individual? How did we end up getting here?
The Social Security situation, I think, can be described in terms of its finances. So Social Security is basically financed on a pay-as-you-go basis. And we have the baby boom retiring now, and it was always known that there'd be large numbers of them, which meant the ratio of retirees to workers would be quite high, and so the costs would go up. In 1982, in recognition of these increasing costs, Congress set in motion a plan to increase the retirement age from 65 to 67. And so that was a way to kind of control costs as things got more expensive when you had this large cohort of retirees. In terms of the shift from defined benefit to 401k plans, I think there are lots of phenomena involved in that. And basically around the 1980s, the nature of the workforce was changing. Women were coming in. Jobs were less physical. People started moving around from one job to another. The environment became more international with competition from overseas. So employers felt cost pressure and wanted to keep their retirement costs under control. Defined benefit plans aren't really very good for the individual if they're moving around a lot. And so you had this convergence of interest between employees and employers that a new arrangement was better. We also had a stock market boom that started then and really continued almost through 2000. And so people got this illusion that they were just brilliant investors as well. And so there was nobody fighting back. It seemed like a good idea on all fronts to move to this kind of defined contribution plan where the individual was responsible for providing for his own savings.
You know, the thing that really strikes me in a figure you refer to your book, the typical total in a 401k plan is about $111,000. And, you know, Professor, if you take a 4% withdrawal rate, that is nothing in today's market in terms of cost of living. And given the fact that, you know, people are living longer, how big of a problem is this? And the reason I ask that is usually it isn't until we're in a crisis mode that you get politicians to act. And unfortunately, if you can see a problem and do something in advance, that problem tends to be less burdensome than if you allow it to, let's say, emerge into a crisis.
So I think public opinion is really changing. I think the turn of this century, that if you said the words retirement crisis, people would say, oh, no, look how many assets we have in retirement plans in the aggregate or something like that. There's a lot of skepticism that it was a really serious problem. I think now it's being recognized as the serious problem that it is. And unfortunately, we're not at a spot where anybody is really focusing on retirement issues. But there are lots of things that could be done within our current financial infrastructure that would improve the situation dramatically.
You know, you talk about the situation. What can individuals do or as a nation? You list basically and you boil it down to three simple choices. One is if you're going to retire, is simply to accept that you're going to be, let's say, in a lower lifestyle than when you were working. That's number one. Second is to save more while you're working, which means you're going to have to cut back on spending today. And the third is to work longer. Before we get to those three options, let's talk about the fact today, if you take life expectancies, I think when Social Security was first put into place, men were supposed to live in their mid-60s. Now they're living into their 80s and women as well. And between a married couple, there's a chance that between the husband and wife, the one of them may live to be the age of 90. So let's talk about life expectancy, number one, and number two, increasing health care cost.
So in terms of life expectancy, I really like to look at life expectancy at 65, because in those early years, there's a lot of infant mortality or death among teenagers, and that is not as good an indication of how much life expectancy has increased as looking at life expectancy at 65. And that's gone about from 12 to 20. So in 1940, a 65-year-old could live to 74. Now the 65-year-old lives to about 85. So those are big increases in life expectancy and a long period over which people have to support themselves. Living longer is a good thing. I mean, it's something we should be pleased about and something to encourage, but it is expensive. And then you have healthcare costs, which have just gone up enormously. And there are estimates around saying that a couple needs about $200,000 at the start of retirement to cover all their out-of-pocket expenses. Well, not many people have $200,000. to do that. And so it's a risk that people are extremely worried about. And what that does is it means that they're very reluctant to spend whatever money they do have because they're so fearful that they're going to need that money for health issues down the road.
You know, one thing that we're also dealing with, as we just mentioned, people are living longer. So that means you're going to need more funds to get you through retirement. Healthcare costs are going up. But also, Professor, we're in an environment where the rate of returns on investment are much lower. Being in the investment business, I can remember in the year 2000, I could easily get between 5, 6, 7% in what I considered very safe investments. That you don't get that kind of return on safe investments today, which makes it harder and requires more assets if you're going to live well.
That's right. You need a much bigger pile. Everything means you need a bigger pile. The low return means you need a bigger pile. Less from Social Security means that you need a bigger pile. The rising health costs mean that you're going to need a bigger pile. So everything has moved in the direction that your pile needs to be bigger. And the mechanisms by which people build up their piles automatically have gotten weaker so that there's more of a chance that people will have inadequate amounts today than they would have in the past.
You know, now that we don't have defined benefit pension plans, and basically 401k plans have become ubiquitous in the private sector, why do you think people do not take advantage of it? As you point out in your book, what is it, half of the individuals in this country have 401k plans, and when it comes to millennials, it's even less.
You're pointing up a really serious problem, and that is that if you take a snapshot of the private sector workforce at any moment in time, half the workers are not covered by any type of employer-provided plan. So they don't have an option whether to join or not join. They're just not offered one at work. And that's one of the most serious issues and one that we need to and can fix if we took some initiatives.
So do you think we need to have legislation where it's almost like a requirement? I mean, if you have a job, you are required to pay into Social Security. Do we need to get to the same level where if you work in the private sector, you are required to contribute to 401k plan? Because as many don't, it's much easier to go out and spend money than it is to save money.
So your point's absolutely right. But the only way we save is through organized saving mechanisms. So we save through retirement plans and we save through paying down the mortgage on our house. And so everyone needs to be covered by a plan. 401k plans are big and expensive and good for big companies. The route that policymakers have taken is to try to set up a system that's described as an auto IRA program. For instance, in Oregon, if you're an employer and you don't provide a plan, your duty is to automatically enroll all your employees in an IRA, an individual retirement account, where 5% of their earnings is automatically transferred to an IRA. If they want to opt out, they can, but this is a way to, with no burden on the employers, because many of the employers who don't provide a plan are small employers. So this auto IRA thing limits the employer's responsibility just to sort of signing up the employee and nothing more than that. But that is an absolute necessary thing to do. It should be done at the federal level. There's been federal legislation proposed, but nobody's followed up. And so the states have taken that into their own hands and are trying innovative approaches to try to provide some retirement mechanism for those who don't have any.
You know, you talk about in today's world, you need more of everything just because of all these costs. Let's talk about one asset that a lot of Americans have, which is their home. And assuming you've lived in that home for a period of time, you're paying down that mortgage. What about using the equity in your home?
Oh, I'm such a big fan of using home equity, and you can access it a lot of ways. You can actually just go out and sell your big house and buy a cheaper house and get some money out and also reduce your expenses because, you know, taxes are expensive and owning a home is expensive. Alternatively, there are such things as reverse mortgages, which have a sketchy past, but really are kind of a good idea today and are well sold in this environment. And then in Massachusetts, we actually have a property tax deferral program that allows people 65 and over with low incomes to say, I prefer to not pay my taxes this year, and then when they die or move and their house is sold, the city gets repaid all the past taxes plus interest. So I think that tapping the home, which is something people have traditionally been reluctant to do, is going to become an absolute necessity, and we need to set up arrangements to make it easy for people to do that.
You know, one of the options you talk about in your book is simply to accept a lower lifestyle. One of the things that we've done in our practice, and, you know, you see this in New York, you see it in California where the cost of living is high and plus the value of real estate is very high, where individuals, rather than reduce their lifestyle, sell their home here in California where they have a lot of equity, it's more expensive, and then relocate to another state where the cost of living is cheaper, whether it's Nevada or Arizona, where you can buy a lot more for your money so they can maintain that lifestyle. What about that as an option? Because it seems like, you know, if you live in a very expensive state like New York or California, that's a viable option.
It certainly is a viable option. I wouldn't start with the number one being that you have to cut back. I think that there are lots of ways where you can still live well by working longer and saving more, but also do just what you're suggesting, which is to move to a cheaper place, and you can have the same standard of living, the same size house, just lower cost.
And let's talk about something that makes so much practical sense, and that is simply by working longer. Say, for example, instead of retiring at 65, you retire at age 70. Well, that's going to do a couple things. Number one, you're going to get a larger Social Security check if you defer receiving Social Security. Number two, working to age 70 means you're going to draw on your assets over a lesser period of time because you just spent 5 years working. And number three, if you are working to age 70 and contributing to, let's say, a 401k plan, you're actually saving more. So let's talk about the option of working longer, especially now since the lifespan has increased significantly.
I think working longer is a very appealing option. Really, I think anybody who's younger today should be planning on retiring no earlier than 70. Of course, there's some people who have health issues or something's happened in their industry so they cannot get a job. But for the vast majority of individuals, working longer is really one of the best approaches to being able to accumulate enough resources so that you can live securely in retirement.
And let's talk about saving and how we fix this problem. We know that Social Security runs out of money, I think, what is it, 2033, so there might have to be a reduction in benefits. How can we fix this system? It seems one logical choice, as we're in the process of raising full retirement age to 67, is raise that to, let's say, a higher age, given the fact that people are living longer.
You're right. The trust fund is going to be exhausted in the early 2030s. If Congress does nothing, benefits will be cut 25% across the board. You still have payroll taxes coming in to cover 75% of benefits. The question is, how should you close that 25% gap? By raising revenues or cutting benefits? Increasing the full retirement age, the age at which you get benefits, is really a benefit cut. And we're already moving from 65 to 67. And the retirement age, people's retirement patterns haven't followed up commensurately. So that means they're ending up with less from Social Security than they would have otherwise. I'm reluctant. I want people to work more, but I'm not in favor of increasing the full retirement age anymore. And those are different things. Actually, staying in the labor force is a good, positive thing that I think provides psychological as well as financial benefits. And as I said, I'd like to see people working till 70, but I don't want to cut Social Security benefits anymore. And the reason is, as you pointed out, the only other thing we have is 401k plans. And those 401k plans have very modest benefits. The number that you quoted was from 2013, and we just got new data from 2016, and still so low. It's $135,000 for a household, 55 to 64, who have a 401k approaching retirement. And so it's just a totally inadequate amount, and working longer is the way to really offset that.
So working longer, as we mentioned, does three things. Basically allows you to save more. Number two, it gives you a larger Social Security check. And number three, it allows you to put more money into savings. So what would you recommend individuals do where, you know, let's say a couple's in their 50s or maybe in their 40s and they're looking at saying, my goodness, we don't have that much money. What should they do?
Oh, I think they have real options. So one is to plan on working longer. That involves letting their employers know that they're there for the long haul, that they're not going to be looking at property in Florida on their computer for the next 5 years. They really plan to have another 15 years with that employer, that they want to be trained, they want to be considered for promotion, that they're serious long-term employees. So that, I think that is very important. The other thing is we just have to get over this reluctance to tap our home equity, because that is really going to be one of the best ways to ensure that we have a secure future. So we have to make sure that happens. The other thing for anyone who is lucky enough to be covered by a 401k plan, to make sure that you're contributing at least up to the amount where you get the full match, if not more.
And, you know, as you take a look at this, I want to talk about another investment. In fact, this was behind many of the defined benefit pension plans where you worked for a company, they put aside a pile of money. When you got to retirement age, they took that pile of money, they went to insurance company, said, all right, given this person's age and that of their spouse, what kind of check can they get? What about, and this is something that I think is going to become more a reality, where let's say you work for a company, you roll over your 401k into an IRA. Let's talk about annuities, where you set up something where, you know, unfortunately, you're going to be spending your principal with an annuity. But what about setting up an annuity in many ways is almost like a defined benefit plan?
You're absolutely right. But as you know, people hate annuities. And so economists have been out there for decades saying, oh, we know just the way to for you to have an optimal allocation of your assets over your lifetime, just annuitize, and that will do the trick. Well, people don't like handing over a pile of money in exchange for a flow of income, even though that's what they get from Social Security, right? A flow of income from their pile. So there's enormous reluctance for a host of reasons for people to buy annuities. And so we actually like something, the advanced life deferred annuity, where at 65, let's say, you buy an annuity that starts at 85. So that is one way to ensure, should you live beyond 85, that you'll have some income. It also says that it gives you a window from 65 to 85 when you know how much you can spend. And it's much cheaper than handing over your whole pile to an insurance company. But annuities, you're right, are an answer. But for a whole variety of costs and other reasons, they're just not very popular in the United States.
And finally, Professor, do you see any indication, given this impending crisis, because it's real, as we just talked about, people are living longer, medical expenses are going up, and more of the burden of retirement is being placed on individuals. Is there any hint, or do you see anything in Washington that people are starting to take this serious? In other words, talk about it and maybe even talk about fixing this problem before we're in a full crisis mode.
I see absolutely no indication at the federal level. The encouraging thing I do see is at the state level, where you have a number of states, starting with California, but then Connecticut, Oregon, Illinois, setting up these state plans that require that employers who don't have their own pension plan enroll their employees in an individual retirement account. So the action at this point seems to be at the state level. I don't think anybody is going to do anything to solve the Social Security problem till we get very close to the point when benefits are being cut. So it's really concerning, because so many things could be done. Just on the 401k, for instance, if we just made everything automatic, that if you had a plan, everybody was automatically enrolled. You could put them in at a low level, low contribution rate of, let's say, 5%, but then you would increase that percentage over time automatically, and then automatically in a target date fund. So if you made that part all automatic, you could have the 401k system working as well as it possibly could. You need to fix Social Security. We need to cover the uncovered, and there we only see the states doing anything. And then having people actually recognize that their house is a very valuable asset that could help a lot.
Professor, what has been the reaction to your book, which is you put it in concise, easy to understand, and lay it out with an action plan that can solve this problem? What has been the reaction to your book from politicians in Washington or around the country?
So I think the book was well received among those who read it. It's not the kind of book that a lot of people read, unfortunately. And so I do think the circulation of our book notwithstanding, that the public perception has changed. I think that now most people agree that we are facing a retirement income crisis. There was a recent study from the General Accountability Office that started with the premise that there is going to be a retirement income crisis. So I think changing the conversation is really important, and I think our book contributed in some small way to that.
One final comment. What about the education itself? Because, you know, we have these marvelous education institutions around the country where we teach people how to become doctors, lawyers, scientists, engineers, but we don't teach them how to manage money or to think about money.
So I'm at a university, so it's very hard for me to come down against education. But I really think the payoffs to financial education have been very small. And what really needs to be done, and the most effective thing to do, is to set up systems where people automatically do the right thing. So that if you have a 401k plan, you're automatically enrolled. So you don't have to make the decision. You are somehow put at a contribution rate that is right for you. And then I think you can use education to explain to people after you've done it why this is beneficial for them. But I don't think we can rely on education at all to get people to do the right thing. They don't want to be lectured. They're not paying attention to this except at a few key moments. And I mean, there's been studies that look at education, you know, when you get this session when you first go to a new job and they tell you about your 401k, if you don't actually make people sign up, lock the door and sign them up right then, it really doesn't have any impact.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because, take a look at how we got Social Security. So we may have to do something along those lines. Professor, I want to thank you for joining us on the program here. An excellent book. So glad to see somebody like yourself and your co-authors pointing out to this crisis because, you know, most people just live their lives and one day they wake up and they find themselves at age 65 or even worse in the last financial crisis, they find themselves out of a job and facing retirement unprepared for it. Thank you so much for coming on the program and the best to you on this book.
My pleasure. I enjoy talking to you.
That concludes my interview with Professor Monell. It's really a well-written book. It's not long. It's very simple. It's very concise. And as she said, there's three things you can do about retirement. Number one, you can just accept you're going to have a lower lifestyle. Number two, you can work longer. Or number three, you can save more. But here's the point. More and more of the onus of retirement is being placed on you. We're seeing it with higher Medicare premiums. We're seeing it with taxation of Social Security. First, it was non-taxable. Then it was 50% taxable. Then 85% taxable. The point of all of this, you want to retire, that responsibility is yours. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.